From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Over the years, I've interviewed a lot of people, definitely in the thousands now. But one of my all-time favorite guests is the fascinating Eddie Wong.
I really think it's a blessing to be born in America. It's a blessing I didn't necessarily earn. Maybe my parents earned it to pass on to me. But in some way, it's like global mobility nepotism. And I would like to, like, pay that forward.
I've said it before. Eddie Wong is James Joyce for third culture kids. His many titles include chef owner of Bauhaus and being the host of Wong's World on Viceland. He's an author, too. His memoir, Fresh Off the Boat, spawned the ABC sitcom. And some people might know Eddie as an outspoken guy, maybe even a provocateur, but the Eddie I know is a super smart, introspective guy who speaks with an authentic voice. His ruminations give rise to all kinds of projects. Eddie recently announced that he's working on a new show, this time about immigrants and food culture. It's called Cash Only, and it couldn't come at a better time. Hi there.
What's up, Evan?
I've actually been thinking a lot about you lately with everything that's gone on with Bourdain, with the whole immigrant insanity that's happening. I'm really curious about the timing of Cash Only, given what's going on at the border and how immigration has become this flashpoint for the culture wars. Have you been thinking about doing something like this for a long time?
Yeah, my thing with the show has always been that my favorite scenes were highlighting the parts of countries or cities or identities that are kind of dormant in our minds, right? One of the best examples of it is, I remember when I wanted to do the Jamaica episode for Vice, and people at Vice were like, make sure you go to Trenchtown, make sure you see parties and guns and drugs. And I was like, look, like, I get it, you guys are the Kids with Guns channel, but I'm not the Kids with Gun host. And I said, I want to go see Jamaican school kids because, like, I remember living in Brooklyn and seeing kids walk home after school with, like, yellow shirts and navy blue shorts, like, from Flatbush to East New York or west to Fort Greene. And I'd be like, yo, what school are those kids going to? Like, that's interesting. And you see all the Jamaican moms, like, bring them home and stuff. So I went to Jamaica and I was like, I'm going to hang out with school kids. I'm going to hang out with moms. And I always remember seeing Jamaican women run businesses. And the first time I came back with the tape device, they were like, this might be the most boring Jamaica episode we've ever seen. I said, no, it's not boring. These are the interiors. You know, this is like Cassavetes. This is like Woody Allen. This is like what I want to see in Jamaica. And I want people to sit and live with people instead of seeing them as some stereotypical Jamaican. So these are the scenes that I've always enjoyed doing. These are the people I've always enjoyed meeting. And now I've found like a partner that wants to see that all the time. Right now, the reason why I focused on these scenes and focused on this message for Cash Only is because I think Americans are having trouble seeing the immigration issue objectively and with clear eyes when it's in our backyard, when they're being told these people coming in are going to take your jobs, which is not true. And then they're afraid these people are going to date their children and become part of their family and then erode their values and continue the dispossession of whites in America. They cannot understand and they will not even listen to the idea of immigration. But I think through this show, by traveling around the world, by seeing the way immigrants are treated and used and abused around the world, they may start to develop some empathy because you can see Bangladeshi people in Dubai. You can see Central Asian people in Russia from the stands. You can see Suriname people in Amsterdam. Every single city in every country, in every continent around the world has an immigrant population doing the shit jobs that they don't want to do. I really just want to fight for global opportunity and mobility.
A quote I read from you recently is something I've been thinking a lot about when I'm just listening to the radio, screaming at it while I'm driving in my car. You say that a lot of the anger towards immigrants could be resolved if it wasn't presented as a zero-sum game.
Yeah.
There's always that thing of the fear of things being taken away. I think that plays into generalized vulnerability. Recently, I downloaded your little book, your little essay.
Yeah.
What's it called?
A Single Asiatic Male Seeks Ride or Die Chick. It's nonfiction. It was an Amazon short story I wrote, a short memoir about like when to say I love you and falling in love. It was like my favorite thing I've written in a long time.
And it really was putting it all out there as a man about vulnerability. How much do you think that what we're going through now has to do with the difficulty of white men being enabled to sit comfortably with vulnerability?
There's just not an ability or willingness to examine oneself or to examine one's privilege. And I get a lot of comments on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook. Like yesterday, somebody on Twitter was like, yo, I'm so happy. Like old episodes of Wong's World are on Hulu. Like it's exciting. You're one of my favorites. And this guy goes, he was one of my favorites until he became a partisan hack and talking about politics. Like he's a partisan hack. And I was like, well, is it possible to be objective about separating children from their families? Is it possible to be objective about white supremacy? Like, I don't think so. Like, I think these are things we should be partisan about.
You've been talking about this stuff forever anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, I have. It's like, when did you tune in? But the thing that I think about the zero-sum game and vulnerability that you're identifying, and like, it really warms my heart, is to say, man, it feels good to not be mano a mano, me versus you, and to think about the world as a global community, because there is enough to go around. And like, there is something magical that happens in human beings when we have empathy and we give and we put others first.
Talk for a minute about Tony Bourdain.
Yeah.
I was just in New York, and when I was there, I went to visit the spontaneous Laizelle Memorial. And lately, I've been thinking about an essay that you wrote for Rolling Stone about him. You wrote, for a lot of immigrants, there's shame when your third world homeland is seen through a Western lens on national television. But there was something about Tony that screamed, I'm not like other white people. I'm not here to laugh at you.
That's huge, man. Because I remember kids coming to my house, seeing chicken feet sticking out of the pot, seeing like sides of beef or oxtail, cuts of meat they'd never seen, you know, flour intestines, and just, this is, what is it? This is crazy. And then we'd be at like parties later that night, and they're like telling girls, yo, Eddie's eating all kinds of animals in his house, and they're like imitating it. And I'd laugh along, and I'd think it was funny, but like deep down, that it really hurts. It really cuts you because you feel like one of those people in Indiana Jones, you know? But the appearance on the scene of guys like Tony and Andrew Zimmern, like, it made us so proud. It makes us so proud. It makes us so happy that, like, our food really does have the meaning that we find it to have. Like, not only is it appreciated and understood and they try to see it through our lens, but then a lot of times Tony would notice things that we didn't notice about our own food or notice about other cuisines we were eating. And that just like brought it to life again. It's like the remix.
It's interesting. I've been thinking of you as someone who's carrying his legacy, but in an even more direct way because of your experience of being marginalized, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And sort of this conversation reminds me of that essay that you, for Vulture, that you wrote in 2016, titled The Oppressive Whiteness of the Food World. I think we had a conversation about it at that time. It was directed at mainstream food media, and you argue that they promote a monocultural white vision of food that creates conditions for some pretty questionable decision-making, like when Eater was discovered to have hired a former skinhead as an editor without disclosing.
And he still works there.
I mean, so that was just a couple years ago. It seems like the conversation in food has changed. Do you find that? Do you think it's just lip service? Or do you think that more voices of different viewpoints are coming to the center and are being given more of a platform?
I'm not even gassing you. There's very few people where I listen or read the food writing. It's you. It's Jonathan. It's Sam Sifton's recipes, which I love and are cute. Lagai Mishan, Pete Wells, Besha Rodel. That's it. You know, because the other stuff is payola. A lot of food journalism is branded content, and I don't trust it. And like, granted, I've done branded content stuff too, but like, I kind of slip in while I'm doing the branded content. Like, this is branded content. Like, I'm very obvious it's branded content. Like, I'm being paid to do this. So like, read between the lines as a viewer. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is how I pay the bills, but like, read between the lines. And man, I loved it when it was like, and even Robert Sietsma, how he would like pound the pavement on Eldridge Street, you know? And it was like Village Voice, Robert Sietsma, he would be finding like out of the cut restaurants, places where nobody spoke English. And he would really encourage you to go to like Super Taste Noodles. And I really thought that was like yeoman work. Like, these are not easy restaurants to get people to go to. Like, it's not an easy interview. You're not even going to get an interview. But, like, you paint a picture, and it's almost entirely on the writer's back to paint a picture and draw the customer and get everyday Americans to leave their comfort zone and try something new. And then by trying something new in that environment that feels very foreign and perhaps quote-unquote exotic, like, you learn something. And you learn a different way to see the world. And it's like a rabbit hole. And it's a peephole into another culture and the way the rest of the world lives. Now, there are a lot of places, you know, they have a social media director, they have a branding person, they have an interior designer. It's still immigrant food, food of immigrants. But what people are not realizing is this is still a product of the upwardly mobile. You know, like, just because it's a Chinese brand that came doesn't mean you're getting a immigrant experience. You're probably getting a dominant cultural experience transported to your country.
Wow. That's going to take a bit to unpack.
So, for instance, I'll say this. It's like Chipotle. It's not Leo's Tacos coming to your town. It's not the tire shop taco coming to your town. It's Chipotle. You know, so a lot of these brands coming in from other countries, they're not one percenters, but they're upwardly mobile. And then, like, they're paying the blog sites, they're paying the writers, it's branded content, and then you're being drawn there. I really miss the discovery, and I really miss the, like, urge to go see something in its own skin, in its natural habitat.
When can we expect to see Cash Only, and where are we going to be able to watch it?
We're signed with Propagate. We're fully done with development, and we've been meeting all the networks, all the channels. We're out to sale, and we'll make an announcement, but it's really an exciting time.
It's been great to have you. Thank you so much, Eddie.
Yeah, thank you.
I've been talking with writer, creator, and Bauhaus restaurateur Eddie Wong. He's working on a new TV show about food and immigrants called Cash Only. In a moment, we'll continue our look at immigrants and food, this time through a delightful new film from Pixar. That's when Good Food continues.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. You might have heard that there's a fantastic new short that's showing before The Incredibles 2. Maybe you've seen the trailer where a beautiful Chinese dumpling comes alive like an adorable baby. The short is called Bao, and it's directed by Domi Shi.
The dough-kneading shot in the opening of the short was very, very difficult to do, and like we really wanted to get those details right.
Domi Shi began to work at Pixar 7 years ago as an intern. Now she's the first woman to direct a Pixar short. Domi joins us from the Pixar studios in Emeryville, California, to talk about the making of her new short, Bao. If you don't want any spoilers, maybe you should turn your radio down for a few minutes. I cannot tell you how much we all here love this little film. It's just so perfect. So, food, I'm guessing you're a big fan.
Yes, very big fan of not just eating it, but drawing it as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. How long have you wanted to go beyond the doodle and really focus on food as a subject?
I feel like I've always kind of made little comics about food or my relationship with food, and it's always just been very relaxing for me to just doodle or draw like my last meal or keep like a food diary of all the things I ate. And when I was coming up with ideas for a short about 4 years ago, I knew I wanted it to be about food in some way because at this time it hadn't been greenlit yet by Pixar. I didn't know if it was just going to be my side project like outside of work. So I was thinking, okay, if I'm going to be working days and nights, like evenings and weekends, drawing one thing over and over again, what is the one thing I can never get tired of? And that's food.
So I've always thought that a really great food film needs to do two things. First of all, the food has to be spot on. The scenes, whatever they are, they have to be perfect and they have to feel real. But also food has to serve the greater emotional story. And so the story that you focus on in Bao, this empty nest of the mom and how she replaces the emptiness with this Bao, how did that spring forth from your own life?
It was loosely inspired by like my own relationship with my mother. I'm an only child to my two Chinese parents. And, you know, ever since I was little, I feel like they've always treated me like a precious little dumpling, like always protecting me, making sure I never wandered away too far. And so I drew upon that relationship that I had with my overprotective mom. And I wanted to use this dumpling, this Bao, as a metaphor to explore that story.
So in the process of doing that, you had to really switch an emotional point of view. You had to go from being the kid who felt like sort of hemmed in and chafed and wanted to break out to understanding completely the mom.
Yeah, that was, I wanted to tell this story from this mother character's point of view because I really wanted to, I guess, learn more about this side of the relationship that I haven't ever experienced. I thought it was just a good way to, like a fun new thing for me to kind of dive into. I love when I'm thinking of new stories, just diving into characters that aren't really similar to me and kind of learning a little bit about something that I didn't know much about before. So I talked to my mom a lot during the course of making this short. I talked to like a bunch of other parents on the crew, producer Becky Neiman Cobb. She became a mom like while making the short. And, you know, I was almost like obsessively or like kind of creepily asking her like, oh, what was it like? What's it like to create something and to hold it in your hands and all that kind of stuff. So
there's that desperate moment in Bao when the grown-up Bao tries to walk out the door and the mom, she prevents it from leaving.
Yes.
And it's so funny because I'd like sort of burst into tears because there were times, I'm an only child of a single parent.
Oh, wow.
And there were times growing up that I felt like my mom was about to swallow me.
Yep. I felt that as well. Yeah. Well, actually, it's funny. That moment, it came from, again, like real life inspiration. My mom, she'd often hold me close, you know, when I was a fully grown adult or like a teenager and be like, oh, like, I wish I could put you back in my stomach so I knew exactly where you were at all times. And I'd be like, oh, mom, that's sweet, but creepy. Which I guess summarizes Bao in a nutshell. But yeah, it's a sweet, it's emotional, it's obsessive, it's creepy, but it's real. And I really wanted to explore this feeling of possessive love taken to the extreme.
So let's talk a bit about the food. I loved so much the beginning where she's kneading the dough, and then especially when she has one hand on the pin as she's turning the dough. I mean, that was so absolutely spot on. That movement is so iconic when it comes to dumpling making. How hard was it to actually animate all of these small motor movements that go into making a dumpling?
Yeah, it was super tricky, and I give all the credit to our amazing effects and animation team. We had really great reference. My mom, she actually came in twice to Pixar to do dumpling making demos for the whole crew. So she taught us all how to make dumplings, but we set up cameras and we basically just recorded and shot every single step of her dumpling making process, which we tried to recreate the shots that we would be using in the short, like the specific camera angles. So when it was time to animate those shots, we had the reference footage and we basically just told the animators, just look at this reference footage, study it, like make sure you copy my mom's movement down to a T. And yeah, they were able to pull it off.
So you're a Chinese immigrant. You were born in China. Are you finding that this movie speaks more to the immigrant experience than to just the child and mom experience? What are you hearing?
Yeah, I'm hearing all sorts of things. I think like a lot of Asian immigrant children and parents have really, really connected and resonated with this short. They definitely see a lot of themselves, like their relationship with their parents growing up, like between two cultures, with the dumpling character in the short kind of, you know, when he's growing up, he's kind of getting into different things and getting new friends, and he's moving further and further away from his mom slash his culture. But also, I think a lot of Chinese people, like from China, have also connected with it too, because, you know, a lot of Chinese people, like around my age, they're only children. There's a lot of only children that are dealing with that as well, with like overbearing parents and being the dumpling that has to leave the nest, but also, you know, balance having a relationship with their parents. So I think it's connecting with different groups of people from all over the world. And also like with a lot of non-Asian people too, which I was pleasantly surprised by. I'm like, oh yeah, that it's great. Because like a lot of people can relate to this very universal story about this overprotective parent learning to let go of their little dumpling. It's not like a very specific Chinese experience. Like a lot of families from all cultures deal with that. And, you know, and even if they haven't dealt with that, there's some people that come up to me and they're like, oh, like I am totally that girlfriend character at the end who, you know, is accepted into the family. So there's are different ways that people are connecting with and identifying with this short. And I think that's really cool.
So later on in the short, when the Bao boy starts to grow up and his mom tries making a huge feast, like a giant spread of food, one would imagine, like his favorite foods, to get him to spend time with her. Can you tell me what was on the table?
Yeah, like each dish what we specifically chose, because those were my favorite dishes that my parents would make for me growing up. So I'm originally from Chongqing, which is close to the Sichuan province in China, where all of the spicy food comes from, like Mapo tofu. And I really wanted to take, you know, use this moment to kind of highlight all of those Sichuan dishes that I grew up eating. There's Mapo tofu in the shot. There's also like dry fried green beans, cucumber salad, cold beef slices, stir fried pork belly. And then there's also steamed fish, which isn't really like a Sichuan type of dish. It's more of a dish that we would order at a Cantonese restaurant. But that was also because I threw that in there because I love steamed fish, like Cantonese steamed fish. And growing up in Toronto with my parents, when we'd go to Chinatown, we would be eating Chinese food from like all over China. So like what's on the table in the short, it's a mix of Sichuan food, of Cantonese food, but all of it was kind of like the food that I love.
The very last scene, the son brings home an unexpected fiance.
Yes.
And not Chinese girl. And in the final scene, sort of the family comes together over the making of Bao. Have you had this experience?
Not specifically like in the short, but my intention with the girlfriend character, the Caucasian girlfriend character, was to introduce this counterpart to the mom character, to introduce a character that was like the complete opposite of the mom character, this young non-Chinese woman that's going to take her little baby away. And, you know, at the very end, I really just wanted to show how food can bring everybody together, can bring different cultures together, different generations. And yeah, like my current boyfriend right now, he's Caucasian, and I think my mom was definitely more impressed with him when he showed her that he could make like different dishes and pasta and stuff. And so there's definitely a little bit of truth behind that scene at the end. I can still make dumplings better than him, though, I think.
I've been speaking with Domi Shi. She's the director of Bao, the new animated short from Pixar and Disney. You can catch it at screenings of The Incredibles 2 in theaters now. Speaking of Disney, Disneyland turns 63 years old next week. When the park opened its door on July 17, 1955, the world was, well, different. The Civil Rights Movement had just begun, and the U.S. had yet to enter the Vietnam War. I was only 2. McDonald's had only just served its first burger, and California's food revolution was still 2 decades away. But even then, food was on Walt Disney's mind.
At the Plaza Inn, it was more of, in Walt's era, roast beef, roast lamb, mashed potatoes, potato salad, something called the Paul Bunyan platter, you know, with cold meats.
That's writer Marcy Carricker Smothers. She's the author of a fascinating culinary history of Disneyland. It's called Eat Like Walt, The Wonderful World of Disney Food. We've been talking about how Walt Disney intended food to be an essential part of the Disneyland experience. So let's talk about Walt. He appeared, despite what he created, to be a pretty simple guy, eating modest foods, things that he was really comfortable and familiar with. What else do we know about his eating habits?
Well, you really summarized it the best. Very simple, despite being one of the most famous men on the planet and could eat anywhere in the world and have private chefs cook him the finest food. As his daughter, Diane Disney Miller, noted, he grew up in an era where it was, you know, hash wagons and food wasn't very plentiful, and that sort of stuck with him the entire time. One of my favorite stories is when he took his crew to Westinghouse to pitch them to be a sponsor for the World's Fair. And they served lobster salad in the executive room. And as soon as Walt got out of there, he turned to everyone and said, "Well, that was a horrible lunch. Let's go get a hamburger and a milkshake," you know?
That's so funny. So that was really an age in which a lot of businesses had sponsorships. And in fact, the restaurants there were sponsored by some pretty big names. Talk to me a bit about that.
Well, in 1955, when Disneyland opened, Walt didn't have enough money or time or manpower to run, as he would call them, the feeding operations, you know, the restaurants, whether they be sit-down restaurants or counter, you know, takeout style. And so there were lessees, over 20 lessees for every single restaurant that was in the park. By 1965, Walt had pretty much taken them all back and owned them all himself.
That's insane.
It's insane. And he had this very clever caveat in the lease. You paid the first year and the fifth year in advance. So there was no way of skipping years 2, 3, 4. You had to pay the entire 5 years to get out of the lease.
So Coca-Cola, Stouffer's, Carnation, they knew when they got in that they were going to be kicked out eventually?
No. I mean, I don't think anyone knew. It was the best intentions, of course, to open the restaurants. It was just as Disneyland grew, that was Walt's aim to be able to run his own restaurants. And some of the lessees did stay after 1965, but one of the big ones was Red Wagon. So Swift's Red Wagon Inn, that was the restaurant that was on Main Street USA where the plaza is in today. 1965, Walt had taken it over and redesigned it, and now it is the Plaza Inn. As it stands now.
So let's talk about hot dogs. They were a favorite of Walt's. Can you share how hot dogs sort of factored into the whole sanitation blueprint of the park?
Yes, Walt loved his hot dogs plain, famously fed raw or uncooked hot dogs. We, of course, are cooked cold hot dogs to his dog. We'd walk in the back door, have a cold hot dog for his dog, cold hot dog for himself. When it came time to open the park, the way that hot dogs figure in is one of the most important foods at the park. In fact, Fantasyland was known as Hot Dog and Hamburger Land. It was just very simple foods on the go for families that were doing the kiddie rides. But Walt helped invent the trash can that we know now with the swinging door. And that's because he did not want guests to lift then, back in the day, the round aluminum lid and see inside all the garbage. And so that was one of the innovations that Walt brought to Disneyland. Where he used them, interestingly, is to pace off the distance about how long it took to eat a hot dog. That was his idea, as he would go from trash can to trash can so that a guest would have no excuse to drop a wrapper on the ground. So it'd start as hot dog at garbage can one, and then he'd stop where he finished his hot dog, and he would have the second garbage can placed right there.
It's a utopian dream. So the park has these four very distinctive lands, Adventureland, Fantasyland, Frontierland, and Tomorrowland.
And Main Street USA is a land, which a lot of people do not realize.
Okay, well, that makes sense that it's a land.
It is a land, and New Orleans Square, yes, right.
And how granular did he get on what was going to be served in each of these lands?
That is an interesting question, how granular. I cannot answer that because I have not spoken to Walt about it. But I do add that everybody in Eat Like Walt knew Walt, no exceptions. So there's no third-person accounts, even if I read interviews with people that work with Walt, like with Herb Ryman. So to answer your question, as best as I know, Main Street USA, for instance, the Sunkist, that was a lessee. Walt loved his oranges. He would famously break in to Sunkist on Main Street USA before the park opened to squeeze his own orange juice. He took great delight in using the, you know, then pretty novel automatic squeezing machines. He'd leave money on the counter and he'd leave. But that was considered breaking in, you know, air quotes, because he didn't own that restaurant. Sunkist did. And Carnation Cafe, he used to go there quite a bit, and he used to, like, sit in the back of the restaurant. But if I had to pick one that was really Walt, I would say it would be the Red Wagon Inn and then the Plaza Inn, because the Red Wagon Inn was a sit-down restaurant. It was a distinctly different idea. It was for families to enjoy fine dining together when they weren't on the go trying to rush from attraction to attraction, and he ate there very often.
Club 33 is this sort of famed ninja dining experience. at Disneyland, it's the one that people really want to get into, the Uber VIP. What do we know about its initial development?
Well, we know quite a bit, thanks to the archives and talking with people like Jim Cora, who I call him affectionately my intern. He worked with Walt since 1957. We talk two or three times a week. So Club 33 was the idea that Walt had. He wanted to have a place where he could entertain people, potential sponsors for Walt Disney World, and also to thank his special guests and VIPs. And it was planned to be above the Pirates of the Caribbean, adjacent to his second apartment. His first apartment is over the firehouse in Main Street, USA. He was building a much grander apartment above Pirates of the Caribbean. You can still see the W and the R in the wrought iron on the second floor veranda above where they sell the gumbo. And there would be a kitchen that would be shared with Club 33, Walt's private club. So back, what is this mystique about Club 33? Well, it has a very exclusive list of members. It's got a very long waiting list. It's expensive to join. And it is the only place in Disneyland that served alcohol, which, interestingly, at first Walt wasn't going to do. He wasn't going to have it available to everybody, but he was convinced, again, because of the entertaining people, that he would have to have alcohol. Disneyland was intended, of course, to be an alcohol-free park from the beginning. The other thing was he didn't want to have paper napkins in Club 33 like the rest of the park. It was going to be cloth napkins, elegant service, continental-type dining. Now, the fun thing about Club 33 is that there's a lot of speculation about where the name came from. And geeks like myself have scurried for years to try to understand it. I know it's not true. It's not true that 33 was the number of lessees when Walt opened Disneyland. That's not true. It's not true, as I understand it, that it was to get a liquor license, because to have a liquor license with ABC, you have to have a physical address. There weren't many addresses, still aren't, at Disneyland outside of Main Street, USA, but there are those in the New Orleans Square. The other one that is true, but probably not the reason that he named it Club 33, was there were 33 lessees at the time that New Orleans Square opened. And I got that firsthand information from the aforementioned Jim Cora, who worked at Retlaw, which, by the way, is Walter backwards. And that was a company that Walt owned all of the things himself, such as the monorail, the trains, the Walt Disney Santana Tiki Room before he sold it back to Disneyland. So Retlaw employees were told, Jim read the memo, it's for the 33 lessees at the time of Newland Square's opening. However, the mercenaries' intel from Walt Disney's family and speculation, but I think it's a really good guess, is that 33 is in fact for Diane Disney Miller's birth year.
Oh, that would make total sense.
And yes, and so Walt loved numbers.
What is your favorite food there?
I just can't pick one. My favorite now, because it would be, I love Bengal barbecue in Adventureland across from Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. I love the veggie kebabs and the chicken kebabs. But I also really do like the fried chicken at the Plaza Inn, and I like sitting at table 13. And another fun fact is that Walt wanted to have bird cages with live birds in the restaurant. And the hooks were installed until they found out from the health department in 1965 that's a no-fly zone. So in homage to Walt, those hooks are still there. And occasionally they hang bird cages with faux birds in them. But I would say that now, if I had to pick one thing, it might not be my favorite food, but it's that combination of eating, of course, and dining isn't just what you're eating, it's who you're with and where you are. Now that Walt's train has been extended along the backs of the River of America, I would say the Hungry Bear restaurant on the second floor, where you can see Walt's train, you can see his riverboat, and you can see his Columbia sailing on the rivers of America with a cheeseburger, with a lettuce wrap, preference no allergy, which is a real fun fact at Disneyland. Because if you say, I would want corn tortillas instead of flour or lettuce instead of a bun, they will ask you preference or allergy. They take gluten-free very seriously, and they have a separate kitchen to go retrieve. So you have to say preference, because otherwise you're going to wait. Like, if it is a preference, you might wait a long time.
So fascinating. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I've been talking with food and wine expert Marcy Carricker-Smothers about her culinary history of Disneyland. It's called Eat Like Walt: The Wonderful World of Disney Food. Coming up, a trip to the farmer's market. We're talking about heritage pork, plus a look at Spanish food through fresh eyes. Stay with us. It's Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. It's that time to see what's fresh at the Santa Monica Farmer's Market. Here's Laura Avery.
Happy summer, happy July. We're here at the Farmers Market today, and I'm really glad to be standing here in the shade talking to Brian Dunsmore. He is chef owner at Hatchet Hall down on Washington Boulevard in adjacent to Culver City, I guess. So tell us what you're shopping for today and what you're going to be making.
Well, today we're shopping for a suckling pig from Peds and Barnett. We're launching a new fine dining dinner series out of the grandma room at Hatchet Hall starting next Thursday. It's going to be called Fuss and Feathers. We're going to be doing old American-inspired cuisine, but it's going to be new American. We're cooking everything by hand with fire, with no technology whatsoever, and with the limitations that cooks had in early America.
Oh, that's why it's called Fuss and Feathers, because it's kind of a throwback to colonial times?
Well, Fuss and Feathers was the name given to Winfield Scott, who was actually the longest-standing military officer in American history, but he was also, at the time, like America's most famous gourmet. He actually demoted this dude to Baltimore, and in this famous letter that he wrote, he was like, yo, dude, this is not a bad thing. This is a good thing. He's like, soft-shell crabs and hogfish are in season in Maryland, and they're the most delicious fish you'll ever eat.
All right, so you're making this fabulous sort of multi-course meal based on early American principles and techniques, using fire, using Peds and Barnett, whole suckling pig. How do you execute that?
Well, the whole dinner is, it's a multi-course plated dinner, which we do all family style at Hatchet Hall proper. But at Fuss and Feathers, it's going to be a tasting. But we want to do something a little bit different, our own style and fully American. And when we were in Japan traveling, we had a really great meal, a fine dining meal. But at the end of the meal, they offered us this gesture course that was like a danabe cooked rice with soup and pickles just to make sure that you're full. So after the multi-course tasting, we're going to go full in to like a whole roasted suckling pig from Peds and Barnett on the table with seasonal accoutrements. So we're going to basically spatchcock the pig, brine it, and then we're going to roast it up on top of the andiron over a bed of coals, which takes about 6 or 7 hours.
And you're basting and turning it, or will it just baste itself?
I'd say 2/3 of the time it's going to be skinned down so the crackling gets nice and crispy. And then the last second, we flip it, probably cook it for another couple hours on the other side.
All the cuts, the whole side?
All the cuts. So at intermission, we're going to do intermission like a movie because it's going to be a long dinner. We want people to get up and be able to stretch and do whatever they have to do. We're going to present the pig at the table whole, and then we're going to take it back and we're going to break it down, crisp the crackling, and then bring it out family style in platters just to make sure. At that point, I don't know if people are going to be able to eat anymore, but it's a nice gesture, and we're going to pack a nice little lunch to go as well.
Sounds fantastic. So to get all those cuts, the ribs, the loin, the everything, you're going to have it all butchered out and like laid out, sort of cut up?
The nice thing about the suckling pig is after you cook it for 6 hours, it's just falling apart anyways. Like when you stick a fork in the pig, it'll squirt juice like 6 or 7 feet. And that's no exaggeration. It's crazy. So you can basically just, we break it and then we pull it and then we separate all the pieces. So they'll be able to, it's like a pig picking.
And for people who aren't familiar with what really good, fresh heritage pork tastes like, this is an amazing experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Through all my days living in the South, eating pork, nobody comes close to Oliver's pigs. The fat on them and the sweetness of the meat is just untouchable.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thanks, Brian. This sounds fantastic. And this will be going all summer.
Yes, ma'am. All summer long, Thursday nights. It's going to be a ticketed event through Eventbrite and our website.
Okay.
So we're super excited, and I hope everybody else is too.
That was chef owner Brian Dunsmore from Hatchet Hall, and he's got some super special summer plans up his sleeve. Southern style, American traditional food using, of course, what else? The best the farmers market has to offer. I'm talking now with Oliver Willey. He is with Peds and Barnett and Sugarbush Proteas as well. Oliver, you have a family farm project where you're growing this special heritage breed of pig. Tell us about the pigs you grow, the breed, where they came from, and why they taste so darn good.
Well, thank you for that introduction. We raise an English breed of pig. We pronounce it Berkshire. Here in the USA, pronounced Berkshire. It's a black pig with white feet. It's one of the oldest breeds that are recognized in the world. So they grow really slow. The meat is really dark, really marbled. And we feed them a very special diet, which sort of amplifies all the good qualities of the pigs. So the fat's really creamy, super porky, delicious.
Is it based on a traditional Berkshire pig diet that they got in England, or did you do your own diet?
We've kind of developed our own, actually, over the course of like 50 years. My grandpa used to raise them in England starting in the 50s, and he was a geneticist, and so he focused on a lot of different traits of the animals, like, and improved them through breeding to make them healthier, played around with different feed mixes. We don't do any corn or any soy, which pretty much every pig farmer in the country does use, but we don't feed them any of that. We feed them a red wheat-based diet, so it's non-GMO. We use barley, and then there's seaweed in the diet, which is not really the norm, but it definitely helps the pigs. It's very good for their digestion. And then we supplement it with, there's acorns on a lot of the trees where we grow them, but they're underneath oaks. And so we're lucky in the fall, they're able to eat a lot of that as well.
Okay, and you do your own breeding, and you raise them all from little baby pigs, and they just live in the orchard. And so you have a couple of mom pigs, a couple of dad pigs, and bunches of babies coming all the time?
We used to breed them, like you call them, like hand breeding, so letting males breed the females. Uh-huh. But it's quite hard to control that, and so we now just keep mother pigs, and we've got about 35 of those, and so we rotate them constantly, and we artificially inseminate them, so we use AI, mm-hmm. because it's much more consistent. It's actually better for the pigs in general. They're not having a 500-pound boar trying to get after them.
Right. How much do they weigh when they're born? Aren't they really tiny?
Really small. Yeah, they're a couple of pounds. Oh. Yeah, tiny little things. Very sweet. Very different from what they look like when they're big.
And how long does it take for them to get to 100 pounds or, you know, like slaughter weight?
Well, the 100-pounders, like what Hatchet Hall, what Brian's using, those don't take very long. You know, it's like 3 months, maybe 4 months, but they grow pretty quickly. To get to full-size market weight, our hogs, because we have them on a slow-growth diet and because it's an older breed, it's like 6 to 8 months typically. Yeah, we don't grow them out that big. Mm-hmm. We keep them smaller because the meat quality, we think, is a little better when they're a smaller size.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about the fat.
The fat is the best thing about these pigs.
I agree.
It's creamy, rich. It's quite high in omega-3s versus omega-6. And you notice it. Like, it's rich. It feels good for you. It's really, really good.
Yeah, and I love your bacon. We love it. We love all the cuts.
That's what I like to hear.
Yeah. Do you sell the jowls too on demand, or do you have those any? Oh, you do.
Nose to tail. Yeah. Honestly, every single thing.
Trotters.
Yep. All of it.
That's good. No waste, and a lot of respect for the pigs.
Exactly. I mean, that was the objective from the get-go, and it took a while to get there. But with some of our restaurant customers, such as Travis Lett from Mountain, guys like Hatchet Hall that take a lot of the fat and render that down, we're able to use all the bones, the heads, everything goes somewhere. And there's a use for every part of a pig.
That was Oliver Woolley, and he is supporting and promoting this wonderful heritage breed of delicious pork that's non-CAFO raised, that's humanely raised in an orchard full of oak trees, and the taste is fantastic. For The Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
The food of Spain is vibrant, playful, but also deeply rooted in tradition. Chef and restaurateur team Jonah Miller and Nate Adler share a deep respect for the cuisine. So much so, they want to share it with eaters in a new way. In their book, The New Spanish, Bites, Feasts, and Drinks, you'll find fresh takes on classic tapas recipes and, of course, cocktails. The duo joins us today from New York City. Hi, guys.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Hey.
So, you're both native New Yorkers. How did you become interested in Spain?
This is Jonah, and we both grew up in New York. Both of us were drawn to food at a young age. I started working in kitchens when I was 14, and that was now a long time ago, about 17 years ago. And Spain was really at the forefront of the most modern, influential cooking. So, you know, as a New Yorker, you think we have the best of everything, and then to realize they're kind of, you know, literally years ahead of us in their techniques, that attracted me. And I had a chance to study abroad there in college and realized there's really, you know, not too many people doing Spanish food and drink in a kind of thoughtful and interesting way.
I got drawn in by Jonah, actually. He was in the process of opening up his dream restaurant in the East Village of Manhattan, which is named Huertas, and we still own today, 4 years later. And we had both worked for Danny Meyer at Union Square Hospitality Group. Jonah was at Maialino as a sous chef over there. And I was the beverage director at Blue Smoke, his barbecue concept. And I didn't have any real relationship with Spain, but upon reconnecting with Jonah and seeing that there was a real opportunity for me to do something special with him and get back into the entrepreneurial side of restaurants, I took a trip to Spain to really eat and drink my way around Madrid, San Sebastian, Bilbao, and even a little bit of Portugal, came back and was sort of inspired by the cuisine and certainly the drink program and what I could do with it at the restaurant.
So the book says that you, quote, calibrated Spanish cuisine for the way we eat today. Explain what that means for the two of you.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two sort of elements of that. One is that, in a sense, Americans are eating much more like Spaniards than ever before. So we're not contented by, you know, a 6-ounce portion of a protein and a sauce and a side. We want to have a little bit of this and a little bit of that to try, you know, as much as possible and to share. So that's sort of a natural fit with the way Spanish eat. But Spanish cooking tends to be, you know, quite heavy and rich and driven by roast and braised meats and stews. And they don't necessarily tinker with that too much seasonally, the way that we have kind of become accustomed to eating in our finer restaurants around the country. So kind of taking a lighter approach and understanding that you can be inspired by a traditional stew, but make it into something you'd want to eat, you know, in the heat of August.
You know, as an Italian cook, I think a lot about how similar both cuisines are when it comes to primary ingredients, but how the use of spices, like saffron, for example, and pimentón, have the ability to completely change those primary ingredients. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think it is a useful analogy for us when we can point to sort of jamón and say, well, there's prosciutto, and it's something that people are familiar with, or a sheep's milk cheese like manchego can be compared to, you know, pecorino. But there is more spice in Spanish cooking. And, you know, I think for us, actually, it's a way to connect green market-driven cooking to Spain by kind of adding Spanish spices in a way that is harder in Italy. If you're cooking, you know, green market Italian food in New York, you don't have the luxury of sort of going to the pantry and grabbing sweet pimentón or saffron, or, you know, for us, kind of that pantry extends to sherry vinegar and Marcona almonds and all these things that allow us to add like Spanish layers to, you know, what otherwise is sort of just straightforward, thoughtful green market fare.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me how just the addition of a spice can make the flavor so much, or the experience of eating a dish so much deeper. It's fascinating to me.
If you think of something like Brava sauce, the classic sauce that goes on fried potatoes in Spain, you know, it's very much like a marinara tomato sauce, but the pimentón, just adding that like great smokiness and depth is what kind of makes it Spanish.
And what about salads? You talk about how salads are different in Spain. You know, we here in Southern California, we have this huge inventory of lettuces. So often our salads tend to be very lettuce intensive. But in Spain, you talk about how that isn't so.
Yeah, I think when you travel to many countries, there's a sort of sometimes a frustrating disconnect between what's available in markets and what's available in restaurants. And so often in Spain, you'll see this bounty at, you know, local markets and not see it fully in restaurants. So you don't see a lot of the vegetables that you see at the green markets in Spain actually hitting the restaurant tables. There are things that people eat at home, of course, where you're kind of having a more balanced day-to-day diet. But when you get a salad in a restaurant in Spain, it's often primarily hard-boiled eggs and a few slices of tomato. And there's very seldom lettuce in salads in Spain, except for in restaurants, that is, you know, except for sort of romaine-like or gem lettuces that are kind of hearty.
You know, one of the recipes that I was really kind of surprised to see, but also fascinated, and one that I'm definitely going to make at home, is the rotos rojos. A lot of people are trying to figure out what to do with the spiralizer they bought. Mm-hmm. And that seems like such a great recipe. Can you describe it?
Yeah, and I think that's the dish we actually sort of lead the readers into the cookbook with, because it maybe best exemplifies our take on Spanish food, in that our version tastes very much like the classic, but the approach to making it and also the finished look is very different. So huevos rotos just means broken or crashed eggs. And it's kind of the greasy spoon truck stop dish that you'll find all over Spain of French fries, but they're fried in olive oil, so they're really not quite so crunchy, but rather limp. A fried egg in either chorizo or chistorra sausage, and then you break the egg and crash it together and sort of make almost like a Spanish poutine. But instead, we also were aware of the spiralizer, and it's a cool tool, and restaurant kitchens often, you know, before people were using it at home, were trying to figure out ways to use that and kind of, you know, create a very unusual look and texture. So we spiralize potatoes and then very quickly fry them, which creates almost like an al dente pasta texture, and then dress that with chorizo vinaigrette. So we take already cured chorizo and grind it up, make almost like a bolognese sauce, but a highly smoky and acidic one, and then dress the potatoes with that and finish it with a poached egg, or if you're able to make a sous vide and slow poached egg, even better.
Of course, I have to ask you about paella. In the rice section, though, you don't call any of the dishes paella. Why?
So one of the things that we wanted when we opened Huertas was to introduce people to sort of a next level of Spanish food and drink, to not to serve paella or not to serve sangria either. And in Spain, really, you know, there are areas like in and around Valencia and also in the most touristy part of every town where you can find paella. But it's not something that's on every table every night in the way that tortilla española is or jamón serrano is. So for us, we didn't even initially have rice on the menu. But of course, it, you know, sort of is a nice thing to have and to round out a meal and is substantial. But if you're making good paella, that's probably the only thing you're doing in a restaurant. But our approach and our arroz frito, so we cook the rice with saffron and we make bacon in the restaurant and add shrimp. So you're getting a lot of the elements that you would in paella, the crispy sokrat or layer of rice and shellfish, pork, and kind of hits those same notes. But we can pick it up in a restaurant in a few minutes. And likewise at home, you can prep it mostly ahead of time and finish it when your guests arrive.
I think many people would be surprised to learn what the national drink of Spain really is. Nate, could you speak to that?
Yeah, so there is a considerable frenzy around the gin tonic in Spain. It mystifies us as, you know, to living in this cocktail culture that has developed in America to think that 20 different gin tonic variations means that you're at a cocktail bar. But if you walk around a city like Madrid or like Barcelona, every bar advertises the gin tonic and they have 20 different variations or 10 different variations, different gins, different tonics, different garnishes. You know, there were two reasons why that became sort of the national cocktail. One was that there was a lot of historical trade with England, with the UK, and so gin was being brought down via the trade, and Spain is relatively warm all year round, and so it's sort of the lightest cocktail to drink. What's not to love about a gin tonic?
Well, thank you so much, you guys.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thanks for having us, Evan.
That's Jonah Miller and Nate Adler. Their new cookbook, The New Spanish, features inventive Spanish recipes created with home cooks in mind. Jonah Miller will be visiting the Now Serving LA bookstore in Chinatown's Far East Plaza next Saturday, July 21st. He'll be signing copies of his book and talking with Kimberly Chow of the Food Book Fair. It's free to attend, but make sure to RSVP. Email hello@nowservingla.com. LA Premier Restaurant Week Dine LA is turning 10 this year. After a short break, we're getting some tips on how to celebrate from Dine LA director Stacy Sun. Stay with us. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleinman. LA's Premier Restaurant Week Dine LA began yesterday. Until July 27th, a handful of fantastic restaurants all around town will be serving up some pretty stellar deals. It's a big year for Dine LA, which is celebrating its 10th birthday. I'm talking with director Stacy Sun to get some recommendations on where to go. It's hard to believe that it's 10 years.
I know. I can't believe it's, you know, all of a sudden your baby's just off to college.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I did it for so many years when I started my restaurant. How did it all start?
You know, it started in 2008, and the initial objective of why Dine LA started was to put LA on the map as a place to go for food. Because if you think back to 10 years, LA was not making all of the top 10 lists as far as where to go eat.
You know, is it my imagination? Looking at this list, I feel like every restaurant is on it.
You know, when we first started, we had 143 restaurants. And then fast forward to this summer's program, we have over 400 restaurants. You know, the variety of restaurants, that has also expanded tremendously. And, to be, you know, you have to go out during Dine LA because there will be a place in your neighborhood or a place that's been on your bucket list, you know, to try for a while.
Do people ask you what kind of strategy they should use when approaching the list?
All the time, you know, and My recommendation is, you know, if you have a list where you've bookmarked restaurants, go to that list first and then just cross-reference it with on our website. The great thing about our website is that you can sort by price point, cuisine type, and neighborhood.
And I have to say that one of the things I've always really liked about the list is the neighborhood option, because in LA, we're so used to going out of our neighborhood to go to like the marquee places or the places we're reading about. And then you might miss gems that are just right around the corner.
Absolutely. And there are a lot of really good neighborhood type of restaurants. And there are some new ones too that are participating this summer, like Wolfdown. Wolfdown is great and it feels very neighborhood-like. It's in Silver Lake and it's a Korean-focused menu. And that patio, it's perfect for the summer. Native in Santa Monica, if you're on that side of town, you know, that's Nyesha Arrington's restaurant. Very seasonal, and she's very much into, you know, making sure that she uses the best produce. And that really comes through in her cooking, too.
Also, what I think people may not expect is the breadth of the high-end restaurants that are on the menu.
Right. So a few years ago, we actually started this new tier called Exclusive Series. And that allowed restaurants like Spago and The Bazaar to participate in Dine LA, because at the $49 price point, that just was too low of a price point for these higher-end restaurants to be a part of Dine LA. You know, this is your chance to go all out and have dinner at, you know, Wolfgang Puck at the Hotel Bel Air. These are places that are very special occasion. So the fact that Dine LA is able to give you that special occasion experience, but, you know, at a greater value, I think that's what makes this, you know, Exclusive Series tier such a great experience.
I mean, there's Providence even.
Yes, there's Providence, and, you know, there's also, you know, Patina. That's a great classic restaurant that's been around for many, many years. And then you also have Maud. This summer is the first time that Maud is participating.
And the Arthur J.
Yes, the Arthur J., a great steakhouse in Manhattan Beach.
Well, thank you so much, Stacy. Congratulations on 10 years.
Thank you, Evan.
That's Dine LA director Stacy Sun. Dine LA runs through July 27th, so make your reservations now. For a full list of participating restaurants, visit dinela.com. Well, that's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. If you dug the show, leave us a review. We always love hearing from you. So many thanks to the Good Food team, Nick Liao, Rosalie Atkinson, Laurel Garcia, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, and Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.